there are these popular messages like chase your dreams, kind of no matter the cost. That is not my message. My message is if you get your foundation solid, you can take so many more risks.
Welcome back to the Most Hated F-Word podcast. I am your host, Sean Maslick. Today, I had a fascinating and interesting and engaging conversation with Emily Burnett. I am deeply interested in stories, especially our money stories. And today, Emily and I really dove into her story and maybe too much at times, I shared some of my story. That being said, most of this conversation was definitely focused on Emily. Yet, I feel like that's the power of sharing our stories, our money stories, is it not only helps us understand and hear other people's stories, but it helps shine a light on our stories and helps us dive into the roots that we talk about on this podcast. Emily is a writer. She wrote a book called Dear Fellow Money Spender and working on a new book that we talk about. She's a consultant and, as she calls herself, an intentional money and life enthusiast. She spent years working in big technology companies while dreaming of building her own business. And you'll hear through our conversation that perhaps this was inspired from her, as she calls, scrappy 94-year-old grandmother. In 2022, Emily left her corporate job to travel and grow her financial coaching practice. Pursuing it full-time revealed that more than coaching, she loves writing, speaking, and meeting people and talking about money in an authentic way. And it's safe to say we did that today. Her goal is to help entrepreneurs and dreamers get and stay intentional about what they're creating and what's meaningful in life.
So for people making decisions with their money, motivated by having the nicest house on the block or driving the latest model of a car, is that even really what you want? Maybe it is. Maybe it is. But do you also want the fact that it locks you into the job, making a certain amount of money that you've been talking for 5 years about quitting?
She shares a relevant quote from her grandmother that's, to plant a garden is hope for the future. Emily's certainly on a mission to do that for her readers. During this conversation, we talk about Emily's story, her work, what her book is really about. Basically, we talk about the richness of the human experience and how much more rich it can be when we dive into our roots to understand what we really want out of this life. And it doesn't necessarily mean we have to be extremely wealthy or have all of our financial orders in fair. Rather, it's understanding what makes us truly happy and how we can spend more time doing that. If you're enjoying these conversations, I would appreciate it if you could support the podcast in one or two ways. You can head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or you can send this episode to your family, friend, or colleague. And now, I hope you enjoy this fascinating conversation with Emily Burnett. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you on the podcast. I have learned you are a neighbor of some sort, having grown up in Montana, and I am Alberta, Canada. So it'll just be a friendly neighborhood conversation about money.
Exactly.
Stories around money. And yeah, for listeners, they know that I'm fascinated by stories, especially our money stories. I think that they're really interesting because stories, while they can be entertaining and engaging, but I think there's this fundamental principle of being human and storytelling as it really allows us to connect with each other. And on the topic of money, I feel like at times we can become so disconnected. So that's why I really enjoy talking about money stories and really why I started this podcast. So welcome.
Thank you. Love it. And I love the focus on stories. I agree.
Well, speaking of stories, I think the only reasonable place to start would be a story of yours on how on earth you managed to make thousands of dollars collecting insects.
Yeah, it sounds kind of illegal.
Only in Montana.
Yeah. I've never met another person outside of my family who has done this. I take that back. There's the person who introduced our family to this when I was a teen. And it's for a very legitimate purpose, for biological weed control. You know, when I tell people I've collected insects and made gobs of money doing it as a teen and early college student, they think I just went out and picked ladybugs and grasshoppers, but they were really, really specific bugs, type of weevil, and they have like a really specific hatching phase, and they grow in only specific places. So you kind of have to put all those factors together and then literally crawl around in the dirt with a mouth vacuum. I mean, it was the least glamorous for a shy high school girl to have, but the money was so good that 1 year, each tiny bug, and we're talking like two or three pinheads, was worth $1.35. And you were finding between six and 60 in an hour. It really was kind of like a modern day searching for gold experience. And we got good at it and sent myself to Europe as a 17-year-old with that money and wasted the rest.
Wow. So you funded a trip to Europe by collecting, I forget the name of the insect you called it, but the vacuum head part
weevil.
Okay, there's the word. I've never heard someone doing that before.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So we literally like suck the bugs up into a tiny canister. And then we collected other kinds of insects that were maybe even worse to collect. We'd like shake an entire thistle into a canvas bag and get every bug on that plant in a bag, even though you only wanted the specific ones. And then you had to count those bugs. And those were long, miserable days, but it did give me a good income as a high schooler.
I was making an assumption that you were collecting earthworms, but this is much more sophisticated.
Yeah.
It sounds like you must have had some desire or some entrepreneurial spirit as a child. You are out there mm-hmm. collecting, sucking up worms. I hope it's not like with a mouth sucking, but regardless it of was. How they were sucked, it was?
Yeah. It was with a mouth vacuum, mouth-powered vacuum.
You would go down to the ground level and suck up the worms?
Yes.
Or the insects?
Yes. So they were never making it in the mouth.
Yeah.
Your mouth just provided the sucking, and then two tubes, one would go into the small canister, the vial, and then the other would be in your mouth. There was a filter or mm-hmm. netting to keep the bugs from crawling up the tube that was in your mouth, except for one of them. And we gave that to our friends when they would come collect insects with us. So they were getting bugs in their mouth.
Oh, wow. Very kind. Wow. Okay. My only experience with something similar is they have these contraptions when your child is young to suck snot out of their nose. And I remember the first time I was given one, I was like, no, I'm not sucking that. But apparently it doesn't go in. And it didn't. But okay. So yes, the entrepreneurial spirit was so strong that it had you sucking bugs into tubes for money that funded a trip to Europe. So it was there. The desire was burning. And now you could see some entrepreneurial patterns and
we'll
get to more of your story. You're written a book, consulting. When you look back at this worm-sucking upbringing, were there entrepreneurs or other individuals who were kind of modeling this way of stepping outside of the, I guess, call it safety net of a job that you could look back and be like, oh, maybe that tendency or the desire to step out of the safety jobs realm kind of influenced you?
Yeah, definitely. And I don't have to look far at all. My dad started his own business as a 22-year-old. And
sucking worms?
Never. No. No, he bought a seat cover shop from his mother, who is the scrappiest, still living 94-year-old you've ever met. And so as a 22-year-old, he bought this business from his mother and just kind of eked by while the family was young. And this thing happened when I was a teenager called the internet that really took his business off. And so, you know, his growth curve was this real exponential growth curve. But even before getting his business online and being able to access business from around the country, I still was exposed every single day to entrepreneurship. And I don't say this with judgment. I say this just as kind of a statement about my dad, that I think he would be a different person than he is had he not had all the exposure to risk and also reward that he did in entrepreneurship. So it definitely was not an easy path, and it wasn't exactly linear for him. But I loved going to my dad's shop as a kid, and he would find ways to employ us and, you know, give us hourly wages, but there were always some incentives. And so he's without question my biggest influence as an entrepreneur myself. But he, like I mentioned, his mother, she has done multiple things for work, for business. His dad was a school teacher and also had dreams and hobbies and side businesses. So there was a lot about entrepreneurship that was more than just money. It was about the creativity of it that has always, always appealed to me.
Can you speak more to that? That's interesting. You said more than just money, the creativity side.
Yeah. I loved the concept that you could have an idea of an improvement in a product or a service. I think I could do something about that. And there's no cap on return. And so even as a teenager, I was experimenting with making duffel bags. And I had, you know, my sights set on becoming the next JanSport or
JanSport
bag company.
I remember those. They've kind of like had a resurgence in Canada.
They've come back. Yeah. So I made a very impressive duffel bag as a 16-year-old. And that is the duffel bag I took to Europe with the worm-sucking money, we'll call it. A terrible idea to pack for a 3-week abroad trip with a duffel bag without wheels. But, you know, back to the creativity, and we'll talk about my grandparents for a minute, that they owned a bakery. And that was very in line with something my grandma in particular liked was she was baking with whole wheat bread or whole wheat and honey before that was even cool. And they thought, hey, we can make some money off of this. So they owned a bakery in downtown Bozeman, Montana. And then they had this other idea. And not all of them were creative ones. She decided to teach accordion lessons. She did not know how to play accordion, but she's plucky. And so she would just stay a lesson ahead of her students. So just the freedom to explore a bunch of different things really influenced me. And back to my dad's story and what I was exposed to as a teen, he manufactured custom seat covers. So these are really high-end seat covers for sometimes brand new vehicles where people wanted to preserve the seats, or older vehicles where people's seats had been worn, the covers had been worn down. He also sold trampolines, which there's no real connection, but it was another way of providing for the family. And for a while, I also was kind of his sidekick in a window tinting business. And we would just do those jobs on Saturdays. So a lot of exposure to trying a lot of things.
Wow. You know, it's really interesting. And you had mentioned earlier, I wrote this down that your dad, these are your words, you said he would be a different person if it wasn't for the entrepreneurial spirit. What do you mean by that, a different person?
I'll just say, or I'll start by saying that he really never answered. Yes, he answered to his customers and demands, but there's just something happens when you answer to yourself. Here's maybe a contrast. One of the things I did not like in corporate was these big company meetings where we would clap for everything, everything under the sun. And I'm a big fan of celebrating milestones and achievements and accomplishments, but it kind of turned into this like, and we clap for so-and-so because they came to work today, or we clap for things that were not huge milestones or celebrations. And that's a really small example, but I'm quite independent. I don't like being told what to do. And I just see that difference. And if my dad had always answered to somebody else and their clock, he probably would have worked less, honestly. He worked a lot to provide. But again, he was letting like his expectations and the expectations he and my mom had for the lifestyle we wanted to have or maintain. And it was pretty modest, honestly. And it took a lot of work to still maintain that. But there's just something about not answering to a manager or a boss that has allowed him to, I think, trust himself, be more comfortable with taking risks than he would have been had he always worked for somebody else.
You know, it sounds like there's this undertone of, with money, we always talk about freedom, but I mean, you use the word freedom, but this freedom to explore, freedom to follow his curiosity, that in some way or another, it sounds like what you're saying is while it might have been more time at work, there was more freedom in that rather than answering to someone and forcing you to clap at weird things.
Yes, you get it. Yes, and that feels like a very accurate restatement of what I've seen.
Can we talk about your grandmother, this 90-year-old, 94, I think you said? 94.
Yeah.
Who you described her as scrappy and plucky. I'm always fascinated by individuals who have seen a lot of time on this earth. And 94 yes. years old, she seems like quite the interesting individual. If you had to, I'm just thinking that you've written a book. If you had to write a book about her experience with living and money, putting you on the spot here, what do you think you would call this book, or what would be the main message?
Her experience living, or her experiences with life and money.
Life and money and navigating the dance that we all dance with.
Oh, yeah. Trying to put that in a title, I think is, I can't do that on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
But it would probably be, It All Worked Out.
Mm.
That's actually one of the titles. I would also say, well, she never tried to impress people. In my experience, she puts a lot of value on non-material things. That is where her entire value is, actually. So she is 94 and she still dances, like square dances, as many times a week as she can. She still has goals she plays the fiddle, and she has expectations of herself that she will practice a certain amount per day. She and my grandfather, who has now passed, are some of the richest people you've ever met in relationships and friends, and the effort they put into people. She doesn't seem to really care about her. I mean, she cares about her appearance. We all do.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as trying to impress people, that's not on her radar at all.
It seems like this free way of living like your father had. And when you said she's the richest in relationships and friends, you can't find many academic research papers on items that constitute a good life that don't focus on the power of relationships. So very, very interesting. She sounds like quite the lady.
Yeah. Oh, she is. I talked to her on Monday and we had some giggles over some fun things. But one thing I would add is she and my grandfather, and then together, they always had and still have dreams. So for them, Alaska was this like frontier. They wanted to go to Alaska and they did. 12 times and they drove 11 of those times from Montana all the way through Canada.
Through Alberta, probably.
To, yes, yes, through your neighborhood. So that is a big part of where I get my dreamer spirit too, is that, you know, what all the money in the world cannot buy you satisfaction, and that intangible, you know, people dream about owning land in Montana. And I do too. I do too. That's my home, but I don't own land there yet. But these dreams that kind of pull you toward the future and keep you from just gazing down at the ground and plodding along. So that's another thing I would add that's very much influenced my life.
Mm. And it sounds like they've done a good job of balancing the two, of dreaming for Alaska, but yet still taking the time to dance and play the fiddle to make sure
that the
here and now is enjoyed.
Exactly.
Well, she sounds like quite the lady, and same with your father. So you definitely had some inspiring role models.
Definitely.
And I think it's so important that we have those role models, or we talk about these stories like this so that others can hear. Because as you know, and I know, like money and a relationship with money, it can be very complex and often misunderstood as we confuse success with this or that. And we often, we kind of lose what makes us really happy, or it sounds like your grandmother has done a good job. And this idea of confusing money stories for me is interesting. And this idea that trying to understand what money means to us, it's confusing. And I want to go to a time that you shared with me in preparing for this, is when you had a partner and you had a relationship. And this is even more complex when we have one person with a complex relationship, like we all do, another person, yeah. And then we're trying to make those two meet. It seems like your grandparents did a good job of just communicating, being with each other, etc. But let's go to this relationship breakdown, as you shared with me. It seems that it served as a transition point. And at times, transitions can be very, very difficult. Sometimes we transition through them differently, and sometimes we don't. Let's go back to this relationship breakdown. And what, if anything at all, did it teach you about money, debt, and all the confusing, misunderstanding things that money brings about?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it wasn't even that traumatic of a relationship breakdown. Don't tell him that. I mean, but we really had not been dating very long. It was a wake-up call for me, and I'll tell you why. So we'd been dating, honestly, just a couple months. And I had judged that he was more financially successful than me. And maybe he was a disaster underneath. I don't know that. But I, again, assumed that he was more together than I knew I was. He had a couple vehicles. He had just bought a second home. He had all the outdoor gear that he wanted. It seemed like he was able to live the life he envisioned for himself. Meanwhile, I was mired in debt, living paycheck to paycheck. Buying a house seemed so impossible, as did getting out of debt. So when the relationship ended, I was complaining about this to my sister, just this discrepancy. And I said, I feel like I'll be in debt forever. And in contrast to him, he's got this, you know, freewheeling life, and I'm locked into this job. At the time, I was really not liking because it felt really limiting, but I still needed that paycheck for sure. And she asked a very insightful question. She asked, well, how long would it take you to get out of debt? And I thought, well, that's an interesting question. I had never looked at it that black and white, like that factually. It had been such an emotional kind of situation that I just thought I would always feel this way and always have the debt and the behaviors that led to that feeling. And so when she asked me the question, it made me think, really, for the first time, like, well, how long would it? And in order to answer that question, I needed to know the inputs. So again, for the first time, I looked in the mirror honestly And I think I mentioned that to you before as we were communicating about this, that like for the first time I dealt with reality. I wasn't just looking at my bills. I was looking at like literally how much do I spend on all the parts of my life and using those inputs, how long would it take me to get out of debt? Surfaced, it would be 3.5 years. And then that was such a switch flipped. I was like, oh, I can do that. And so it was like the shame bubble got burst that night. The hope was like 0 to 60. So it really did almost feel like an overnight transformation in what I believe is possible. And kind of coming back to what I've observed in my parents and my grandparents, that after that transformation, I was so much more in tune with what I even wanted, that I was so much more willing to challenge a store clerk or somebody who was, I thought, overcharging me. I'd be like, wait, I thought it was on sale. Whereas before, I didn't want to rock the boat. I didn't want to attract attention to the fact I might be trying to save money. And so I felt like I was just able to like be a lot more free, even though I still technically had the same amount of debt and was still paycheck to paycheck. Again, just there was such a huge emotional shift. Yeah.
Thank you for that. I like this idea that you're talking about, you're still in the same financial situation, being in debt at that time, but there was this emotional shift where you're feeling free. When you think back to that feeling, what was the biggest difference between one to the other? And I know you said you let go of the shame. It's just making me think for other people who might still be in debt or other financial technical things that they're working on. But yeah. What was that shift in the mindset that allowed you to feel free?
You know, the word pretending comes to mind. And before I took that honest look in the mirror, it was like I was pretending. I was pretending I didn't have the problem that I had. I was pretending I had money I didn't have, and credit cards made that possible. And so once I took that honest look in the mirror to just acknowledge whatever the facts were, not the ones I wanted to see, but just all the facts, it was like it kind of gave me permission not to pretend anymore. And so I did not care who knew that I was working on getting out of debt, because there was nothing to hide. And also, I knew where I was headed and that it was very possible, that it did not depend on any austerity measures except those that I chose to make. And there were some that I was like, oh yeah, I want to cut back there. But yeah, that word pretending comes to mind. And it is something I see pervasively in clients I have coached, in people I have worked with, just the pretending is so exhausting, because all your energy is going to pretending that either you don't have a problem or that you can afford the life that you maybe can't. But the first person you have to stop pretending to is yourself. And then it doesn't matter who else knows.
Appreciate that. In a world of social media and where people are pretending all the time, I think it's hard to see beyond this mirage of this life that we want to construct, and we try to will ourselves or pretend ourselves or pretend that we're living it. And below, we know there's this discomfort that lies. It kind of sounds like you got cast out to the social media modern world sea, but then lessons from the scrappy 94-year-old grandma came back.
Yeah, because the first one happens just by default. It really does. Mm-hmm. And so zero judgment to anybody living in that. It's still, again, like the slippery slope. I am taking a very intentional 10-day social media break because I can recognize in myself, like, oh, sucking me back in. But yeah, that's the default. So what I feel so strongly about now is helping people create space in their life so they can hear themselves. And even if you like the people you're following on social media and you like the inputs, you have to have time without inputs so you can hear your own voice, so you can hear, get back to the wisdom of your 94-year-old grandmother and the values that you actually really want to live by. So I feel like so many people are living lives they don't even want, but they're so busy living them that they can't think about what else. And that's what I want to help people create.
Transition to your book. It seems like a lot of the core is around, is what I've heard online you talking about, is intentional living and intentional money. Maybe speak to those two. You write it as an equation. So I feel like that's kind of in and around what we're talking about, but maybe speak specifically to that intentional living and intentional money.
I've had clients come to me and they say, I'm ready to budget. I want to budget. And great, we'll work on that. But there was no why yet. They were doing it because they should. And I felt like they wanted to talk about the cart and I wanted to talk about the horse. Like, but why? Why do you want a budget? And also, the structure of your life is making it really hard for you to manage, be proactive with money. An example would be, have you heard of KonMari? Maria Kondo, the founder of The Magic of Tidying Up. She's like the queen of minimalism.
Say goodbye to your clothes. Thank you. Get rid of them.
Yeah.
I think that's what she says.
Well, but express joy first.
Express joy. Yes, express, that's what it is. Yeah.
You know, imagine that you're living in a life that is, or a house that is crammed to the gills with things. You're going to have a harder time organizing that house in any meaningful way than if you reduce it by 50% and just like gain clarity. So then you can organize it. And so that's what I would see in clients is we'd be working on their money, but they are out of control, busy. They're reactive with the way they're spending their money and time. So they'd say, I really want to change my money. I feel like I'm ready. I want to get out of debt, but it can't take any time because I don't have time. And I wouldn't hear that with judgment, honestly. I would just think there's so much more to this whole like life thing than the money. And so the intentional living that I like to talk about includes like choosing who gets on your calendar. And like, instead of living reactively with other people's expectations, exercising a level of intentionality about what you even want. And so it's really, you kind of can't lift, it's like two ends of one stick. You can't lift the intentional money end is good, but you also have to lift the other end of the stick. And again, it's to the end of getting what you even want, which may not be the same as what everybody else wants, or it may not look the same. So for people making decisions with their money, motivated by having the nicest house on the block or driving the latest model of a car, is that even really what you want? Maybe it is. Maybe it is. But do you also want the fact that it locks you into the job, making a certain amount of money that you've been talking for 5 years about quitting? So you just can't piece apart money. And that's what I saw people wanting to do. Oh, no, I just want to talk about money. And that was really dissatisfying for me because I know there's so much more potential for them to live a life that isn't just reactive.
You know, it goes back to this idea of stories and the stories we tell ourselves. If we're just detaching a segment of the story, it sounds like what you're saying is that it'll just pull you back in. And it's really understanding, like you've said, what do you want out of this?
Well, and that's one reason why the middle section of my book is benefits to proactive money management. Because people would say over and over, oh, I should budget. And I'm like, no, it's nothing you should do. It's like, I lovingly wanted to like shake them by the shoulders and be like, no, actually, this is like such an exciting thing. And so I kind of went on this crusade of like marketing branding or marketing and rebranding budgeting to turn it into something like, it is the biggest gift you could give yourself because of what it will invite into your life. Peace, a life audit, control in a world that feels out of control. So selling the benefits of proactive money management to come at it differently and circumvent the shoulds, because you.
Mm-hmm. Shoulds have an undertone of, I don't want to do this. For people who are like, oh gosh, you cannot convince me about budgeting. There might have been some people who just turned this off because they heard the word budgeting, which is fine.
Yeah.
I like this idea of, you said peace and control. I mean, big deep desires that we all have in life is having some peace or contentment and control. While I know it's intuitive how that would come from a budget, but just speak to it, because I think it's overlooked. People will be like, yeah, I know that is. But what I'm kind of thinking here is perhaps that's the reactive response that you've been talking to about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've used the phrase oasis of control when I teach people about the B word, because I spent a lot of time in that zone where I would hear that word and be like, I'm doing it and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work for me. So something must be wrong with me or budgeting in general. So I very much understand resistance to the budget word. And that's why throughout my book, I try to rephrase it as often as possible to proactive money management or choosing how you spend. I can see how somebody who's in a position of resistance would be like, that sounds boring. And I'm a very fun-driven person. So I resist things that sound boring. So working on that, choosing how you spend. But the oasis of control was one of those phrases that when people would hear that, they'd kind of be like, I'm interested. I like that. Because I do think we have so much coming at all of us. I'm on the like mellow level, but I know there are so many people who have so much coming at them. They've got all the kids' soccer stuff and the school stuff and the life management and then social media and the things you like to listen to. And so this idea that there's like a calm space where you get to organize your numbers, again, according to how you want, and a space that is outside of your head that you can see it working, and then it helps you. It like assists you as you go into life. It's a very grounding practice. I found it to be more grounding in some ways than like meditation, because it is one of the main commodities of our existence is the money, because of what else it enables. So to have that space be ordered ends up creating more order in your life.
You know, I have met people who have been hyper-focused on budgeting. And I guess we're speaking at two different ends here of the spectrum. One is, hey, I can't hear this word budget. And now we've got the individual who's hyper-focused on budgeting. Every line is accounted for. Every dollar, 62 cents that's spent, they're asking their spouse, well, that wasn't in the budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How, if anything at all, have you positioned or talked to these individuals that might be hyper-focused on budgeting? So they're doing the act of it, but there might be a gap in the intentional living part.
Yeah, for sure. To be honest, they're not the ones typically coming to me. Because the title of my book is Dear Fellow Spender, and my messaging has resonated with spenders.
Yeah. Which so they're like, I got this figured out.
Yeah, the ones who have a hard time spending. I have not had that many conversations with them. But to me, it comes down to, it's like an unhealthy, meaning an unhappy approach to trying to control something. And so I guess I would just ask, like, is it getting you what you want? Is it getting you the peace you want in relationships? You know, so So I don't have a lot of experience coaching or even speaking to those individuals, because I have really focused on the ones who are maybe missed by traditional messaging, traditional money messaging. Like, they avoid even any personal finance book or talking with their financial planner. If they're married, they leave that to the other person in the relationship. So that's really who I have wanted to serve, because that's been my own experience too. Mm-hmm. So sorry, not a lot to add there.
No, that's good. Yeah. And yeah, the title of the book definitely, I can see, would make the spender, to use the word of the dear fellow spenders, permission to pick up the book, and not so much of, oh, I'm doing it all wrong, I'm not going to pick up this book. Mm-hmm. It's in the title that, hey, we spend, so maybe I should check this book out.
And the fellow part's important.
Yeah, right? That's a good word, fellow. And you showed some empathy that you were a spender, or maybe still are. So let's talk about that. I think I think too often, especially in social media, it's like, follow me if you want to figure out how to do this or cure your spending habits. Mm-hmm. This seems to be, when we're honest, let's go to your scrappy grandmother who does the ballroom. Was it ballroom dancing?
Or square dancing.
Square dancing. So dancing. Mm-hmm. This is a lifelong dance, I feel, that we don't talk enough about. That it's not like we cure our inner spender, if that's what we are.
Yeah, that's honestly one reason why I have kind of backed out of financial coaching as it's largely practiced. Because there is messaging like, I'm a financial coach. That means, you know, I would introduce myself that way. And people would be like, oh yeah, I'm really good with my spending. And I'm like, I'm not. I mean, I plan it, but there are, I'm sure, plenty of people who would be like, and you bought shoes? You know, or there is this kind of, it goes back to pretending, you know? Mm-hmm. Pretending that you're not the person you really are, that you don't have the values or priorities. I like shoes a lot. And I, by accepting what is important for me to spend money on, I don't feel guilty about it, except for when I put myself in a role where people expect me to not now be a spender. Because what I'm really good at doing is taking risks. And that is not something that most financial coaches talk about. And making decisions that maybe financial planners would not like sanction on paper, but my intuition and my gut says, oh yeah, you're so worth taking this chance on. And the experiences I've had in the last year and months have brought me to such a different place. And so money is a piece of this pie. But when I was kind of locked into, I am a financial coach, there were these expectations of what financial coaches do and don't do. And maybe some of those I put on myself. Either way, they felt limiting. And I get way more excited about talking about somebody's dreams and goals and, you know, living fully present right now. Well, fully present, that's kind of this elusive thing. But enjoying life now and not trying to spend like everybody else, so that you can spend how you actually want. And so I'm way more excited about helping people like create that space to have those conversations with themselves. Because I'm not going to tell anybody, oh, you should only be spending X amount of your budget on such and such categories. Like, I just don't have those answers for anybody else. So yeah, I'm happy to say I'm still a spender, and it's not something I'm like working on. I am working on being more of a creator than a consumer and like measuring that balance. But again, I'm not trying to be less of a spender, and I'm not trying to make spenders less of spenders.
I like that perspective. It seems welcoming. And for people who have that feeling of a spender, it's not like you're saying, you're broken, I got to fix you.
Yeah, no. If they are, I am too. And let's just go like dream big together. Yeah.
take some risks in your own risk capacity? Because you said, like, in the last year, you've experienced things that you couldn't if you didn't take those risks. And I think that's the interesting thing about navigating this money journey is, on the other side, if we're not, at some point, it's not like we want to risk everything, but if we don't step outside and try new things, there might be a whole part of life that we don't get to experience.
Totally. And to that end, I've left multiple jobs, like four, to go into the unknown. And I always had something that I was going to work on, a project or a business I was going to work on. As I have taken those leaps into the unknown, my foundation has gotten more and more sure. Because I think there is this really appealing thing of, like, just chase your dreams and chase your passions and it'll all work out. And I think that is terrible advice for somebody whose money is a mess. They have not looked at it. They're not organizing it. Like, and I'm not saying somebody shouldn't do that because it's wrong. I'm just saying that is going to be really, really painful. And you will enjoy that risk, that leap, so much more, and be able to hear what it is you need to hear when you are not, you know, going off to college with $200, which is what I did. And that was, you know, I was taught better. I just needed to learn my own way, because I think there are these popular messages like, chase your dreams, kind of no matter the cost. That is not my message. My message is, if you get your foundation solid, you can take so many more risks and you can count on yourself so much more than you can when the roots. So my first company, when I was financial coaching, my company name was Moso Money. And Moso is a type of bamboo that apparently grows slowly at first. And then when its roots are established, it grows like feet in a day. And it grows so fast, so tall. But the roots have to be right for that growth. And what I see, and I have some experience with it myself, is that it's easier to focus on the growth. Like, yeah, I'm going to quit my job and go travel Europe, but the roots are not healthy and strong. And so it will crumble. Or if you're building on a foundation, or if there is no foundation, that building will crumble at some point. But if there's a foundation, whatever you do on it, whatever you build on it, will last. So I just wanted to clarify that in case somebody was getting the message that is like, yeah, just caution to the wind. Quit your
YOLO,
job tomorrow, no
it?
Savings. Yeah, yes.
Prior guest, he's been on twice now, Dr. Ted Klontz, he talks about the tree of life. And it sounds very similar to what you're saying, but just this idea that the roots, yeah, they have to be strong in order to support the trunk, the canopy of the tree, et cetera. And I like this messaging, because I think, going back to something that you were talking about earlier, we can be very reactionary with our money. And this desire to, I'm going to take a risk and try this new company, this YOLO, so to speak, could almost be like I'm running from something as opposed to I'm running to something. And I think that's what I'm hearing you say, is establishing these roots, then perhaps let us know a bit more about us, our money story, so that we can take this leap that's intentional, back to what you've talked about. So I think it's a really strong message.
Yeah, I agree. It is a strong message. And the only thing I would add is that I experienced firsthand, maybe I was just slow to pick this up, but like, you benefit immediately when you focus on the roots.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss that. You know, every message I was hearing, or the way I was hearing it in my head about budgeting or personal finance or habits and routines, sounded like it was going to benefit me way down the road. And I'm a little bit more of an instant gratification person. And so I like to emphasize that these are things that benefit you starting like right now. today and your future. Because again, I'm not great at waiting 20 years for satisfaction and reward. You get it today and you get it exponentially in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've all experienced that when we focus on our own roots, thinking inside, reflecting of some sort, you can feel good. And to your point, you're building strong roots. My curiosity has been percolating. At the start of the conversation, there's a few things that linked together this thought. At the start of the conversation, I think you said as a shy person from Montana, and we've been talking about this or dancing around this idea of more as a reaction, especially driven by social media and how without examining our roots, we might be reactive and chase more. The reason why I'm bringing this up, I'm going to send it back to you in a second, is when I grew up, I was a super shy kid, and a shyness was my identity. It silenced me. I hid behind silence because I was shy, so I didn't have to talk. And it was when I started understanding my money story that I realized that I became a financial planner. I was obsessed about money because at a young age, I started associating money with power, a voice, to be heard, all things that a shy kid aspires, like this, just recognize me. I'm not going to say anything, but recognize me. And so I attached this meaning to money that it gave me a voice and it gave me power. I'm throwing this out there as a curiosity from a shy person to another. we grow from that, you know, like we grow and we learn from ourselves. Mm. How, if anything at all, did being shy impact your relationship with money?
That is an interesting question, one I've not really looked at that specifically.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe it hasn't. This is purely for me, so.
Yeah. Well, I will just say to substantiate the shy bond, yeah. I was so shy that I had to write out a script to call and order pizza.
I can relate. We have a shy. I was so shy, use your words, that in my group presentation in university, I mumbled the entire part of my presentation so that no one would hear me. And there was beads of sweat dripping on my armpits onto the floor. I made that last part
wow.
up.
But, yeah, well, it's poetic. It's a poetic addition. You know, I think there is an element of, and maybe it's not particularly the shy thing, but not feeling like enough, you know, and wanting to fit in certain ways that fuels most of the getting in me. I'll speak about me, even though I think it applies widely, are these markers of success. And you think if you get those markers of success, you're going to feel differently. So some of those markers of success that I pursued, definitely job stuff, you know, career accolades. At around 30, I realized I wanted more income opportunity. So I left my job and I went to the Bay Area and I retooled my career into web development. And I was so much of a rookie that I did not even know what a cookie was on a website. I didn't know what HTML stood for, but I just thought I can learn to like anything and I can learn new things. So here I go, and I entered web development, and it was a good decision. It doubled my income, but yeah, I was still me, and I had only started spending more, but again, not feeling great about myself. And I actually, that's a pretty profound contrast. You know, doubled income, felt this way, got serious about budgeting and paying off my debt, felt so much better about myself. And again, some of that, like back to the shy connection, if there was one, shyness is hiding, right? And I didn't feel like I needed to hide certain parts of my story any longer. So there was kind of this flourishing in confidence that you're helping me see right now.
I think it's really interesting. This, like, almost verbatim, I had the same experience that, like, the shy is this version of hiding. And when you speak about it, It seems like it's liberating in the sense of I don't have to hide anymore. I had the same experience with promotions and it seemed to never cure it until I looked at those roots and been like, oh yeah, hey, I call him Mr. Shy, actually, my inner money critic.
What's interesting as we're talking about this is I've seen the opposite be true in that somebody who acts really confident, mm-hmm. but maybe isn't, you know, it's some people maybe compensate by hiding, others compensate by appearing extra. If the shy ones are hiding, then the ones who still feel crummy about their spending because it's not matching the vision of their life they maybe had as a kid, you know, what mm-hmm. they actually wanted to be doing, they maybe compensate by acting bolder and they can experience the same relief when they decide to stop pretending.
And this is why I think it's your advice about really looking at your roots is applicable to everybody, because whether you're shy or you're seeking attention by that loud individual that the shy kids can never get mm-hmm. a word out in class, if you know what I mean, we're just like, quiet, mm-hmm. I want to say something, but I'm not actually going to say it. I'm just saying that you're going to, but there, I feel like, and not just my feelings, from what I understand is seeking that attention, that being valued and loved, and they do it in a boisterous way, whereas a shy individual wants that attention, but we just don't do it in that manner. But we're all seeking that, am I enough? And what I have found and hear you saying is these roots, examining our roots is a very fertile way to find that enoughness.
Definitely. And like shape your own definition or
So I see the time here. Sorry, I just dove into the shyness. And you know what? I'm curious if there's people listening and they were shy as well. I would like to hear from people because I think it profoundly affected my money story. But this is about you. You're the guest. So I am going to stop talking about Mr. Shy. As we come to an end here, what is interesting you the most in your journey right now? Is it your book? Is it your writing? What, I guess, message do you want to be able to speak to? And whatever that message is in around intentional living, intentional money, or anything in around this conversation.
Thanks for that question. So I'm writing book number 2, and it's follow-up to Dear Fellow Spender. This one is called Dear Fellow Dreamer. And this one really, it's a kind of existential book for me to write, because the person I have in mind for this book is somebody who is in a safe corporate job where they're miserable. But they've been miserable there for a while, and yet there they stay. And so putting myself back in that place, because I can relate, it's an invitation to kind of wake up, because like I mentioned earlier in the conversation, there are things I've learned in the last year and couple months of traveling and listening and in a lot of ways disconnecting from, I mean, I've not social media entirely, but like, what is it I really want out of life? And what is it I, like, what would be enough money? And what would I do if I didn't have to work? I've considered that question before at a very high level. And I'm like, you know, come up with some stuff. But I've really been examining it as I've met people in the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early. Like, truly, what does a meaningful life look like? And for a long time, my messaging was like, get your money in order so you can do more. And somewhere along the line last year, I was like, actually, how about less? Mm-hmm. How about get your money in order so you can do less of the stuff that is reactive and more of the creative stuff? And so I'm so interested in reaching those people who, again, feel stuck. They have this like restlessness in their soul. Some of them may be mired in debt like I was and living paycheck to paycheck. And so leaving that job or leaving corporate feels impossible. And I want to help them start being the boss of them, like right now. Maybe they never go on to create their own business, but to start creating these boundaries, these better like I take good care of me and my money and my time so that I can do things that are important to me. So that is my challenge, to try to put all of that into a book in a coherent way, but very much on foundations and what you actually care about, what you actually think, what you actually want out of life. Because again, the default is busy. It's doing what everybody around you is doing. It's hustle. It's reactive. And I just want everybody to explore this kind of magical, like, you know, this picture, this mental image is coming. And this is maybe fitting, since this is where we started, of my grandfather. So he taught school. He actually really liked it. He was a really gruff guy for the first 3 months of the year. And then he started smiling around Christmas time. So he liked what he did for work because it didn't define him. He was his own person. And one of the mental images that I have is him sitting on the bed of his truck. He and grandma built a property out in their canyon. And it was rustic, not fancy, but it was paradise to them. And he had time enough to sit on the bed of his truck and just admire the hillside across from their home. That encapsulates so much that, like, the whole point of living is not to hustle, 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 get to a point when you're 70 years old and then you start taking cruises and golf. Maybe you do some of that, but this richness, I'm fascinated by the richness of the human experience that I think we're missing in the way we work and the way we seek for money and then the things we do with it or don't do. So that's what I'm interested in right now. Just that.
That image, I feel, I don't know. I cannot get out of my head an image of your book of your grandfather sitting on the tailgate with your grandmother just admiring what they've created and in his gruff clothes. And because you're right, there's a richness of the human experience. We don't talk enough about it, but that's kind of the intent of all of this.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It's meaningful to be able to talk about it with you.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. Very, very interesting. And I think your grandfather would be some proud of that book.
Ah, well, I hope to. I hope to make him proud.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some of your story with me. For listeners, where would you point them towards your website, your first book, and any other place online?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I mentioned, I'm kind of evaluating my social media relationship. And that's not just for me, honestly. Because of what I care about, I don't really want to encourage those who are interested in my message to consume, consume, consume. Anyway, so the safest place and the place I am very consistent is on my email list. And on my website, I've got all kinds of good stuff with plans to release a whole bunch more. It's emilyburnett.me. They can find my first book there, and that's definitely where I will be promoting my second book. And I send emails that include travel stories. I spent 10 years in tech, so I will be sharing a guide for those who want to start their business and what not to do when building a website. I've done it good ways and I've done it bad ways. So practical tips that help somebody who's like, I want to get more intentional with my own human experience. So that's where they can find me and get the good stuff.
Well, thank you. And I guess a closing message from your grandmother is, in the end, it will all work out, hey?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and one thing I just add, if I may, to the grandmother thing. She travels a fair amount between her winter home and her summer home. She always carries this little quote, came from the Reader's Digest 30 years ago. And it says, to plant a garden is to have hope for the future. And I think that conversations like this, I come away feeling more hopeful. And I hope that listeners do as well. The whole reason any of us, get out of bed in the morning, do anything about our money management and simplifying is because we do have hope in the future and creating something beautiful for that future.
Very well said. That is a wonderful quote.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Thank you for tuning in this week to the Most Hated F-Word podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Emily Burnett as we explored her money story. Until next week, have yourself a good one.
I'm on a mountain without a top. My wealth is measured in how I spend my time. But now I write freedom story with every breath inhaled. Money is not the boat of life. It's just a wind in the sail.